So we're holding on page Chof Aleph and Sota Os Memzain. We learned in the Mishnah more examples of Midah Keneged, of how Hashem rewards people Midah Keneged Midah. We have the whole thing with Miriam staying for Moshe, and that led us into that whole discussion. So now the Mishnah says another example, Piska, quoting from the Mishnah, Yosef Zocha Likbaris Avivachola, Yosef had the schus to bury his father, Yaakov, and in return for that, when they left Mitzrayim, then Moshe, Noah, and Moshe and Yosef is the greatest of all his brothers, and therefore when they left Mitzrayim, no less than Moshe Rabbeinu was involved in taking Yosef's bones out. So let's deal with the details of that story of Yosef burying Yaakov. The Gemara is going to ask, by the way, later, what do you mean only Yosef? All the brothers were involved. So we'll get to that point later. But anyway, so first of all, the Gemara says, Maishna Me'ikra. So let's consider the distinction. At the beginning, so the Torah describes, and in the last parak of Bereshis, it describes the whole funeral procession. So first it says, Vayal Yosef Likbar Eslaviv. Yosef went up to bury his father, and all the servants that were paroi went up with him, and all the elders, all the respectable people of Mitzrayim, and then it mentions Yosef and his family. Then it mentions Yosef's family and his brothers and the rest of his father's household. So in other words, the implication would be that first you have the Egyptian dignitaries are going over there, and then after that, Yosef and his family. Well, Maishnal of a Soif, whereas afterwards, after the Levaya, when they're on their way back to Mitzrayim, Dichtiva Yoshev Yosef Mitzrayim, Ahuva Echav, it says Yosef returned to Mitzrayim, he and his brothers, V'choder, and only then, V'chola Ulam Ita Likbar Esaviv, and then everybody else who went to bury his father, and Marsha points out, who would be the Chola Ulam, must be the Avde Pare Zikne Besay, all the Egyptian dignitaries that we said at the beginning. So why on the outbound trip were Yosef and his brothers last, and now they're first? So Amar Avichan and Betchila, what happened was like this. At the beginning, Ad Shalei Roh B'Kvodin Shal Yisrael, before they saw the glory of the Jewish people, Lo Nagu Bahem Kavod. The Egyptians did not treat Yaakov and his family, even Yosef, that so respectfully. Meaning they still took the view, you know what, we're the Egyptians, we're more important, and therefore we should go first. All of a sudden, later on, though, they saw the glory of Yosef and of the rest of Yaakov's descendants. Page Chof Aleph, and yours, it's Os Mem Zayin in Sota. Just paragraph number 47 in Sota. Now that they saw the glory of the Jewish people, Nogobahim covered, and they treated them more respectfully and had them go ahead of him. Dichtiv, now where did they see? What changed their mind? What did they see? Dichtiv, the pasuk says, Vayavoyu ad Goren ha'otod. The pasuk says they came to the threshing floor of the otod. Otod is a thorny branch. It's a thorny plant. It's translated as brambles or something like that. So the question is, brambles, thorny plants like that, Goren is a place where you thresh grain or other similar kinds of produce to remove the shells and whatnot and make it more edible. But you don't do that with otad. You don't take thorns and thresh them. So why is the place called Gurdon HaOtad? And Marsha points out, it can't just mean that it's surrounded by thorns, because usually you wouldn't name you're going to give a threshing floor a name, you're not going to call it after something lowly. First of all, you're not going to call it by an unimportant plant that grows around it. It would be like calling it the threshing floor of the weeds. You wouldn't do that. You would call it by its location, by its owner, or whatever. Second of all, also, many times, yeah, people would often, back before they had barbed wire, people would often use thorns as hedges around their fields or gardens or threshing floors or whatever to keep wild animals and thieves and whatnot away. So therefore, in that sense, so either, in other words, you wouldn't name it, if it so happens that brambles are growing there, that wouldn't be a reason to name the place that. And more to the point, it's more likely that people would put that there deliberately as a hedge. So therefore, so why is the place called Gurdon HaOtad? Om Rav Abahu, so Rav Abahu explains, Malamed, Shikifuhu Ksorim La Roina Shal Yaakov, it means that Goyish kings came, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, and they surrounded Yaakov's coffin with crowns, to Gurdon Zesh Makifin LeOtad, like a threshing floor surrounded with brambles, the same way like we're saying, you take those thorns and you put them as a barrier around the threshing area so that wild animals and whatnot don't come in, so it's surrounded by spikes of thorns, the same way you had all these kings are hanging their crowns on Yaakov's coffin out of respect for him, and therefore it was like surrounded with crowns. So therefore they called the place Gurdon HaOtad in token of that. So what happened? So Yitzchak on the side over here points out an interesting point about it, the Yaakov, and more collectively the Jewish people, are the purpose for which the world was created. Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world for the sake of people who do Torah and mitzvahs. Everybody else are like thorns that are less important, and at most they're there as a hedge to prevent danger and whatnot. So now these kings realize that, and in token of that, they put their crowns on Yaakov's coffin, as if to say, you know what? We recognize now that compared to Yaakov and his children, we're nothing but thorns. So what happened? Shaboshem b'nei Esav b'nei Shmuel b'nei Keturah. The children of Esav and Yishmol and Keturah all came over there to the funeral. Now, why did they come in the first place? Tana, kulam l'mochamabo. They actually originally came from war. They intended, they figured now that Yaakov has passed away, his chus won't protect them, and therefore they figure they can attack. Marshal also adds, he brings from the Medrash, from Bereshis Rabbah, they also wanted to prevent Yaakov from being buried in the Ma'aris Machpelah. We're going to talk about soon how particularly Esav fought against it, but in general, all of these kings are coming to try to prevent it. Kivin Shiro Kisrei Shor Yosef Shatole Ba'arona Shor Yaakov. But then they saw Yosef's crown hanging on Yaakov's coffin, because Yosef was after all the viceroy of Egypt, so he wore some kind of crown, some kind of insignia of office. So now he took that off and hung it on Yaakov's coffin as a to show respect for his father, like his father deserves the crown more than him. So now that they saw that, and they knew how important Yosef is, at that point, Mitzrayim was the world power. And Yaakov points out, after all, only a few years before that, during the famine, Yosef had supplied everybody throughout the entire known world with food. So now when they see Yosef's crown hanging over there, they realize that, you know what, this is somebody we have to respect. Not to kulam kisrehem, then all of them took their crowns, or tlonim ba'aronos shel Yaakov, and they also hung them on Yaakov's coffin. So therefore, the coffin ended up being surrounded by crowns, like the way a threshing floor is surrounded by thorns and brambles. Ben Yehoyada makes an interesting point over here. He says, you know what, so what changed? What exactly were they? They see Yosef's crown hanging over there. How does that change things for them? He says, you know, up until that point, everybody thought that Yaakov's family are kind of like the black sheep of the family. They're like the Nebuchs of the family. Esav, Yishmael, B'nai Keturah, all of them already have kingships. They all have lands of their own. And meanwhile Yaakov and his sons are a bunch of nomads, and they're not even in their homeland. They're in exile and in Mitzrayim. So they thought, you know, why should we bother giving them any respect? But now they realize that, no, on the contrary, Yosef and Yaakov and all of them are extremely important, and therefore they outrank them, and therefore in token of that, they took off their crowns. Tana, we learn in a Braisa, Shloshim v'shishak sodim nitlo ba'aronish Yaakov. 36 crowns were hung on Yaakov's coffin at that point. Where do we get 36? So Rashi explains as follows. In Parshas Chayesara, when it lists the children of Yishmael, it says there were 12 sons, and all of them became Nesiim. All of them became princes of tribes within the nation of Yishmael. So that's 12. Then you have, when you come to Esav, you come in Parshas Vayishlach, Aluf this, Aluf that, Aluf the other, you have 23 of them listed. And Rashi actually points out, you actually have 25 of them, but what it is you actually have two of them, Tamar and Knaz, that are listed twice. And then you have, because you have, there's different listings of Alufim over there. You have Alufim at the beginning, when it lists the descendants of Esav, and it calls each of them an Aluf, a leader, or a duke, or something like that. And then later on, at the end of the parasha, it mentions the 11 Alufei Esav, who were after their kingship fell apart. Then it mentions Alufei Esav, and you have over there twice where it mentions Tamon in each of the two lists, and Knaz in both of the lists. So Rashi says, you also have Korach is listed twice, but that there were in fact two different Korachs. So in other words, you have 12 from Yishmael, 23 from Esav, that's 35. Elsewhere, by the way, the Gemara has an expression, now Aluf is an uncrowned king. So we don't literally mean they were wearing crowns necessarily, but in other words, they're wearing some kind of insignia of office. Anyway, so therefore, you have 35 between Yishmael and Esav, and then Yosef's own crown is 36. So there's your 36. A number of Mephoshim have various problems with Rashi's explanation. First of all, the Gemara is mentioning over here that B'nai Keturah showed up as well. Well, what about their kings? Why aren't their kings, crowns added to the total? And also this, that Rashi is saying, for example, that you have, that the Maharsha points out, when Rashi is saying there were two different Korachs among Esav's descendants, the Medrash actually identifies them as the same person and explains that he's listed in two different family trees because he was a mamzer. So he was seemingly the father of one man, and really he was fathered by another man over there. So it doesn't really work. So a number of them are first about different counts of how we get to 36. Tosfos Shamas, printed on the side of the Gemara, says rather you have to count as follows. Another consideration they say is not all of those Alufim of Esav lived at the same time. Again, the order basically was they started developing a nation, they started developing into a nation, and they had their Alufim, they had their local chiefs and warlords and whatnot. Eventually they put together a kingship, and they had the famous eight kings of Edom, and then after their last king died and they had no more monarchy, then they reverted to Alufim. So it's not historically all the same time. So Tosfos Shamas says rather you do have to count B'nai Keturah in as well. He says therefore what you have is you have 12, you still have the 12 from Yishmael, he counts 10 from Midian, because Midian had 5 sons and one of them had a couple of other sons of his own, and then you have 11 from Esav, so altogether again you get 36 that way. The Rosh gives yet another calculation, and Maharsha says they had the Kabbalah, there were 36, so what would it be? Fine, we can't get it by counting all the Alufei Esav and Alufei Yishmael, we would have to count others as well. He brings from the Medrash that there were kings of Canaan who came as well, and they also added their crowns to the coffin. So one way or the other, you get 36. A number of Mephoshim point out various symbolisms why Dafka 36. First of all, the word Keser is the same letters as Kores. And you have, the Mishnah says at the beginning of Masechta Krisos, they have 36 Averis for which a person is Chayav Kares. So now Yaakov gets the polar opposite of that. He gets 36 crowns in token of that he was careful, unlike these Goyim who are over on one or another or all of these mitzvahs. He was very careful with them, and therefore he deserves to be honored with 36 crowns. Another point is also 36 is chai plus chai, so it represents he lives in this world and he lives in the next world, because Yaakov ben Uloi Meis. Ben Yehuda points out you have the six major spheres of Zoh, Chesed, Gvura, Teferes, Netzach, Yisod, Hoid. Each of them incorporates some of all the other ones, like we have in Sferes Omer, and therefore 6 times 6 is 36. So that's another reason for the 36 crowns. Reb Levick, the Rebbe's father, also mentions that first of all, the Gemara is going to soon talk about the idea of how Yaakov told his children how he had bought the space in Maros Machpeli. He had bought it off Esav, because otherwise Esav would have had a claim to it. He uses the word Korisi, that I bought it. The word Korisi is also the same, and most of the same letter is also, the most of its letters are the same as the word Keser. So therefore, in token of that, he had Ksorim, and as far as the 36, he points out, first of all, So a couple of things in it. He points out a couple of gematrias in it. One of them is that when you have the expression in Masechta Tainis, when it talks about Yaakov Avinu Leimeis, the chid bichdi, is it for nothing that the grave diggers dug and the embalmers involved and whatever? The word bichdi is gematria 36, and the word vichi over there is also gematria 36. So you have a couple of 36s also in that symbolism as well. And he points out some other things as well in that regard. Okay. Next. So that explains, so in other words, after that whole thing, after all of that, the Egyptian dignitaries and noblemen and whatever who had come to the funeral, they realize now for the first time how important Yaakov and his family are, and therefore they had them precede them when they go home. They walked in back, like, we realize now we're the inferior people compared to Yosef and his brothers. The pasuk describes by the funeral, by Godan, by this place. Oh, also Reb Levick points out another interesting point as well. We said the name of the place was Godan HaOtod. Now you take the letters of Otod, Aleph, Tes, Dalad, and multiply them together. Aleph times Tes times Dalad equals 36.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So the pasuk says that, so there in Godan HaOtod, the pasuk says, Vayisvedusha misbit Godor v'chovid ma'od. They made there a very great and heavy mourning. So what do you mean the word heavy? So at Tonim, we learn in a Braisa, afilu susim v'afilu chamorim. Even the horses and the donkeys joined in the morning. Now, what does that mean? There's a variety of different explanations. Maharsha says it might be, he mentions in his times, for example, when a king or a nobleman died and they would have the funeral procession, they would put black cloth on the animals as well, as if to show they were also participating in the morning. So it may have been the same kind of thing over here, where they dressed the animals also in mourning clothes. The Rif mentions a point that it may be, for example, that they starved the animals. They didn't give them food, so that this way the people are crying and wailing and whatever. And now you have, in addition, you also have the horses and the donkeys are also braying and neighing and adding their voices to that as well. Ion Yaakov points out, you know, the fact is when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, the famine ended, and therefore now the people and the animals have lots to eat. Now that Yaakov passed away, the famine resumed, therefore the attack of the animals have very good reason to participate in the mourning, to instinctively participate in the mourning as well, because they're not getting as much food as they were before. And then Yehoyada says also another possibility, the Susim and Chamodim over here may refer to people who are pulling wagons and carts, sort of like, you know, you have like rickshaws in the Far East, so therefore they're called Susim and Chamodim because they're functioning essentially as Susim and Chamodim. Okay. When they reached Ma'aris Machpelah, where Yaakov is to be buried, also Esav became active. Then Esav came along and was trying to prevent Yaakov from being buried over there. He says, listen, the place is called Mamre Kiryat Ha'arba Hu Chevron. It's called Mamre because that was the name of Avraham's friend who used to live there. Kiryat Ha'arba, he Chevron. Now, why is it called Kiryat Ha'arba? Arba means four. V'omra Yitzchak, Kiryat Arba means Arba Zugis. There are four couples that are buried in the Ma'aris Machpelah. Odom B'chava, Avraham B'sara, Yitzchak V'rivka, Yaakov V'leah. And Marsha goes into a little bit of detail over here that there's earlier psukim that call it Mamre Kiryas Arba, but there you could say Arba is maybe the name of a person. The Medrash does in fact say as much that you have the names of the three giants over there, Achiman, Shesha, and Talmai, and their father's name is Arba. But here where it says Mamre Kiryas or Arba, you don't put a hey before a person's name. You don't say, for example, Ha Reuben or Ha Shimon. So therefore, by the same way, Ha Arba can't mean the person named Arba. It would have to be the four, as in the four couples. Anyway, the point is we see from that there's supposed to be four couples buried over there. Marsha actually relates this to a halacha in Bava Basra, that when a person sells somebody else an area for graves, then they arrange it in such a way that there's eight grave sites per burial cave over there. Anyway, there's supposed to be eight spaces there, says Esav. Ihu kavra l'leah t'sanau, so far three couples have been buried over there. Odom Chava, Avraham, Sara, Yitzchak, Rivka. So there's two spaces, so there were two spaces left. Ihu kavra l'leah b'didei, well, Yaakov already used, now he and I, Yaakov and Esav, have inherited equally from our father Yitzchak. He already used one of the two spaces for Leah, that Yaakov himself mentions in Parshas Vayechi, says, v'shama kavartias Leah, so Leah had passed away many years before him. Therefore, Esav argues, v'hai depayish, there's one left, hudivihu, it belongs to me. So therefore, I have the right to be buried there, not Yaakov. So Yaakov's sons tell him, what do you mean, zavintu minach, or zavinta, you sold it. You sold your rights to be buried over here. Omalahu, so he says to them, Nahid is a bini b'chirusa. Sure, not you sold your rights specifically to the grave. They tell him, listen, you sold your b'chura many years ago to Yaakov. And in Parshas Toldos. So what are you complaining about? So he answers, Omalahu, Nahid is a bini b'chirusa. Sure, I sold my rights to be the b'chura and got a double portion compared to Yaakov. Pshitusa mizvini. Where do you ever see that I sold my rights as a poshut? So fine, I shouldn't get two-thirds of the Yerusha, but I should get half of it at least. So therefore, I should be entitled to one out of these two graves. Marsha goes into a little bit of arichus over here about does this mean that he's arguing that maybe he's entitled to an entire grave plus maybe part of another one, or maybe he's only entitled to one whole one. Whatever the case, the point is that he's arguing that I should have certain rights over here, and you can't just take away my rights altogether. So they told him, yes, as a matter of fact, you did sell your right, you did sell away your rights to be buried in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah at all. Dichtiv, Yaakov, our father, told us before he passed away, B'kibri asher korisi li be'eretz Kanaan, I want you to bury me in my grave, which korisi for myself in the land of Canaan. Now, the poshut pshat of korisi would mean that I dug. But the graves are already dug there. Yaakov doesn't have to dig it for himself. So the word kira over here is actually an expression of selling, so or buying. So he's saying Asher Korisi Li, that I got Esav to sell to me, and I bought from him the rights to be buried in this place. And we know that we know that the word kira is used in that sense. Shekhen b'krakei ayom, kira l'mechira kira. Because in cities near the sea, their word for selling is kira, instead of in regular Lashon Kodesh, mechira. So therefore, Asher Korisi Li means that I bought it for myself. Rashi brings from, you have an example of a pasuk like that in the Navi Hosea, where it's not just in Krakeyam. You have an example where the Navi Hosea refers to, he uses a pasuk for a kreholi b'chamisha asa kasef. I purchased her for myself with 15 silver coins. So we see that the word akreha, same shirish as karisi. So therefore, it means that I bought. So Esav says to them, Hovali Igeres. Well, you claim that I sold it. Show me the letter. Show me the document that I sold it. Omrulay Igarta Bayer de Mitzrayim. He did tell them the documents in Mitzrayim. Uman Nezel, so Esav is still trying to prevent this, still trying to prevent them from burying Yaakov. So they say among themselves who should go and get that document as fast as possible. Nezel Naftali, let Naftali go. To Kolo Kayalta, he's as fast a runner as a gazelle. Distiv Naftali Ayala Shlucha Hanusin Imre Shofer, as Yaakov gave him in his bracha. Naftali is a swift gazelle that gives forth beautiful words. So therefore, he's a swift runner, so he'll go and come back the fastest. And Al Tikri Imre Shefer Ela Imre Sefer. You have another layer of meaning over there, because not just Imre Shefer, beautiful words, which has a meaning in and of itself. Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, for example, that it means Devora and Barak were from Sheva and Naphtali, and they sang the beautiful Shiras Devora. But it means, in addition, it also refers to this particular situation over here, that he's going to bring Imre Sefer, the words that are written in the document, namely, that shows that Esav signed away his rights in the Maris Machpelah. So they're all standing around and waiting for Naftali to come back with us. To come back with the document. Meanwhile, Chushim ben Don Tamon Hava. Meanwhile, Chushim the son of Don was there. The Yakirim Leudne, his ears were heavy, meaning he was deaf. So he doesn't know what's going on. Omulahu Maihai asks him what's going on, why is Zadie's burial being delayed. Amulah Kama'akim Hai, they tell him this guy, Esav, is holding things up. Abdi Yasin Naftali, Ma'arid Mitzrayim until Naftali gets back from Mitzrayim. Omulahu, so Chushim says, how could we do that? Bad Osi Naftali, Ma'arid Mitzrayim, Yehe Abi Abba Mutu B'Bizoyan. Meanwhile, my grandfather is going to be lying over here in Bizoyan and not buried until Naftali is able to get back. I can't tolerate that. Shoko Kufa, he picked up a club, Machia Reshe, and he bashed Esav over the head with it. Not through Enei, Esav's eyes fell out, Naflan Akara B'Yakov, and they fell on Yaakov's feet. Interesting points that Beforshim say why Esav was punished in that way. Why does he want to be buried next to Leah anyhow? If Leah's already buried over there from years earlier, why is he so hot to be buried over there anyway? So there's the idea. We know from the Gemara and Baba Basra, it actually brings it on the Pesukim, that originally Esav wanted to marry Leah. And then when it turned out that he's a Rosha, so Leah was crying her eyes out to prevent that she shouldn't end up marrying a Rosha like that. Nevertheless, Esav still had designs on her. So now he figures, if I couldn't have her while she was alive, at least I want to be with her after I died. So his eyes that are looking where they don't belong get to fall out. Get to be knocked out. As far as why it falls on Yaakov's feet, an explanation from Tiferes Tzion is, you know, one chus that Esav did have that Yaakov didn't. There were many years when Esav was living in Eretz Yisrael when Yaakov was off in Haran, he walked there on his feet. So you would think, therefore, maybe there's a certain way in which Esav is better than Yaakov, but no, we're saying the feet are not being held against Yaakov for that. He had good reasons, good and valid reasons, to be out of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore he deserves to have that Esav's eyes will fall at his feet, Dafka. Paschinu Yaakov La'ene, at that moment, Yaakov opened up his eyes. Remember, this is 70 days after he had passed away, but here, you know, Yaakov ibn Olaymes. He opened up his eyes and saw what happened, va'achich, and he laughed. He's happy to see that the Rosha had finally gotten what he deserved. Thus the Pasuk says, Yismach Tzadik Yichozem Nokam, the Tzadik will rejoice when he sees the vengeance of Hashem. It's always a good thing when Hashem allows us to see how the Rishoyim get what they deserve. You have many times in Sefer Tilim, for example, where David asks, Hareini V'Shodaroi, and other expressions like that. So it's always it's not a matter of personal vendetta. It's a matter of there's been a Chilul Hashem, that a Rosha is successful, and therefore it makes a great Kiddush Hashem when he gets his comeuppance, and Yaakov is very happy to see that. So the tzaddik will be happy when he sees the vengeance. Pa'om of yirchatz b'dam ha-rosha. He'll wash his feet in the blood of the rosha. So here, like his feet are being bathed with the blood. You can imagine when Esav's eyes popped out of his head, a lot of blood probably came with it as well, and all of that is landing on Yaakov's feet. So that pasuk is literally being fulfilled. Marsha actually points out, it's not just that one pasuk. You look at several pasuk, this is in Kapitel Nun Ches and Tilim, you can find a whole bunch of pasukim in that kapitel that clearly refer to Esav, which is why the Gemara is darshaning the pasuk about him. You have in the kapitel, you have the expression, Zoro Rishoyim Merochim. The Rishoyim are estranged even from the womb. And we know that already in the womb, Esav was trying to get out whenever they passed by a place of Avodah Zarah. So already in the womb, he's estranged from Malchus. Then Tov Mibet and Dovrei Chozov, the pasuk continues, those who speak falsehood have gone astray since the womb. That means, in other words, that here he's lying and claiming that he didn't sell the grave site to Yaakov. The pasuk continues, Chamas Lomik Mus Chamas Nochash. They have a venom like the venom of a snake, because Esav, being the Koichas HaTrumah, he's associated with the snake, as in the Nochash HaKadmoni in Gan Eden. And here he's trying to use with his Hamas, with his anger, he's trying to prevent the burial. Then you have the pasuk continues a couple of psukim later that he'll be punished to mefesin chedesh, like a to mefesin chedesh yatim oznay, like a deaf viper who stops up his ears and doesn't want to listen to the charmer who's trying to calm him down. That deafness refers over here to Choshen Ben Dan, the deaf Choshen Ben Dan who gave it to him over the head. And he's smart. He understands why they sent Naphtali, and therefore the Kim Haros Shinei Mefima Yashem break his teeth at his mouth. It's like when he got bashed over the head. And then Nephil Ashes, Balchazur Shamish, the pasuk describes in that capital, like the stillborn mole. Mole has no eyes or non-functional eyes that never saw the sun. Like Esav over here, that was the last time he ever saw the sun, and then he's a goner. And then you have this pasuk that the Gemara quoted, Yismach Tzadik Yichaz Anokam. So we see that much of that capital is actually referring to this whole episode and to Esav's whole life story. A couple of interesting things in this regard. First of all, Tosfos elsewhere mentions that even though the Gemara is saying over here that Choshim knocked him over the head and caused his eyes to fall out, that didn't completely kill him. He was still alive after that. Yehuda gave him the final blow, which we learned in Gittin, we learned a few months back in connection with the Gemara in Hanizokim,
he's not to his heart, people talk about left.
Later on, the Romans, who are always associated by Chazal with Esav, they had it specifically in for Shevet Yehuda and for the people living in the territory of Yehuda, because they blamed Yehuda for the death of their ancestor. So that was Yehuda gave him the final blow. Another point is also, why is it Choshen Ben Dan is specifically the one to get involved over here and be the one to knock Esav out? So Ena Yitzchak on the side over here points out, you know, you have like this. Here, Esav is arguing with them and saying, I didn't sell the place. Yeah, we have to remember, Esav was a very smooth talker. For years, after all, he had been able to convince Yitzchak that he's a tzaddik, after all. So now, you have to imagine, says Ena Yitzchak, you have to imagine the scene over there. Esav is trying to tell them, you're telling me I sold this place in the Aras HaFeil? I would never do such a thing. I wouldn't sell it for all the money in the world, b'chola b'chola, and making all kinds of pious-sounding arguments like that. And the Shvatim, you know, they maybe may not have known what to believe. Okay, you know what? And Esav is saying, yeah, your father told you that I sold the place. And maybe he didn't know what he was talking about. Maybe he was senile or something. And, you know, the Shvatim don't really know what to do. But Choshim, being deaf and not having heard that whole conversation, he doesn't know of any of these chochmas of Esav's. He doesn't know of any of Esav's nice speeches. And all he knows is this guy, my uncle Esav, is trying to prevent my Zaidi from being buried and offered his head then. So there's that. There's also a vote, there's a Musadik vote on it, brought from Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. You know, people, you see something intolerable. The first time you see it, it's shocking, and you can't stand it. But it's easy enough to get used to it and to think, you know what, this is how it is, and we'll have to live with it. So the same way over here, the Shvatim, as great as they were, nevertheless, when they're having to wait around while Naphtali is going to run off to Mitzrayim and get the document, meanwhile they're starting to like mentally make peace with the situation. Okay, we guess it's going to have to be that. Yeah, the Yaakov's burial is going to have to be delayed. Again, Choshen not hearing what's going on, he doesn't know of any of that. He's not getting used to anything. He sees there's a problem over here. Whack. He wasn't used to anything, unlike them who are starting to get used to the idea that there may have to be some kind of delay here. The pasuk says, so the Gemara continues, but Oysa Shan is Simon of Oysa Shal Rivka. At that point, Rivka's Nevuah came true. Now, it wasn't a full-fledged Nevuah. Rivka is not listed as one of the seven Nevias. But nevertheless, like we learned before about Basia, about Bas Parai, that she had said certain things that are recorded in the pasuk, and she didn't realize the full import of what she was saying. The same thing with Rivka. So Dichtiv, the pasuk says, Lama Eshkag Am Shneichem Yom Echad. Years earlier, when she tells Yaakov to run off to Haran, she tells him, why should I be bereaved of both of you, of both of my children, on one day? Meaning she's telling him, in other words, because Esav is going to try to kill you, and you're going to try to defend yourself, and you're both going to wind up dead on one day, and therefore better you should run away. So now she had had that premonition, and now it actually came true that they actually, she did, in a certain sense, lose them on one day. Now, they didn't actually die on one day, because here, after Yaakov passed away, they had the 70 days when they were embalming and mourning for him, and then you have the whole time it took to get to Eretz Yisrael, and they're in the 7 days of Shiva and all that, so it was a couple of months after Yaakov had passed away. Nevertheless, the fact is they were both buried on the one day, because Esav was killed on that day, and Yaakov was buried in the Maris Machpelah. The Zohar, by the way, says after, so again, we said that Yehuda chopped off Esav's head. The Zohar says that the head rolled into Maris Machpelah and then ended up in the embrace of Yitzchak. Reshid Esav v'itfoy de Yitzchak. The head of Esav is in the wrappings and in the bosom of Yitzchak. The rest of the body is people took and then took it back to Seir and buried it. There's places in Chassidus and in various Sfarim that talk about the symbolism of that. Esav had a good head on his shoulders in the sense that he had great capacity for good things. It's often brought in some places that if he had been good, he could have been greater than Yaakov. He has the power of Koyach of Toihu, the Oris of Toihu, and so on and so forth. But it was only in his head; it got blocked, so to speak, by his neck from reaching the rest of his body. So therefore, his body remained Esav, but his head deserves to be in Yitzchak's embrace because there were good things in his head, which later on came out of his descendants. We learned in Gittin about Nero and Caesar, the Roman emperor general who became a ger. We have Antoninus. We have a few other examples of famous descendants of Esav who became gerim and became tremendously great people among the Jewish people. So all of that is symbolized by Esav's head, and therefore his head belongs in the Maris Machpelah. You go, by the way, nowadays, to the Maris HaMachpelah, you can see, so nowadays you have there's a building over the Maara that was built, as far as we know, by Hurdus. But so the actual Kvarim are someplace underground, and then you have the building with all the monuments inside that are marked with the names of the Abbas and the Maharis and all that. You have in front of it, there's a big hole in the ground, or at least there was the last time I was there. You ask the tour guides, they'll tell you that hole is where Esav's head fell into. Is that really true? I kind of doubt it, but tour guides, they gotta keep people's interest something. Yeah, the Dubin Bolaya, most likely, yeah.
One years ago, it wasn't there.
Okay.
Something
they made, they say
some sheikh is buried there or something.
Could be. I don't know. The hole in front of Maris Machpelah. Yeah. Fine. So the Gemara says now. Okay, so that's the story of Yaakov's burial. So now the question is, we're saying, again, the Mishnah had used the expression that Yosef went to bury Yaakov, and therefore in the schus of that, Moshe no less dealt with finding Yosef's body. The question is, if Yosef hadn't gotten involved, wouldn't the brothers be involved as well? Why are we speaking of only Yosef doing it as though like they're not getting involved? In fact, the pasuk says, "Vayisu oisav bonav aretz Kanaan." The pasuk clearly says his children carried him to Eretz Kanaan. Rashi, in fact, even brings the seder from the Medrash that Yaakov had given instructions that three of his children should carry on each of the side, the same way as they're going to have the Golem in the Midbar hundreds of years later. So all of them were involved. Why are we attributing it to Yosef? The answer is Omru, the brothers themselves said among themselves, and Nichuloi, leave him that Yosef should be the main one to be involved. It's more of a covered to Yaakov that it should be the king, or Yosef, who's practically the king, should be directly involved with arranging the burial and with spearheading it more than us, who are compared to him, are commoners. So therefore, that's why they left it mostly to Yosef to deal with. Not to say that they weren't involved, but in other words, they realized that they should play second fiddle to Yosef because he's the king, and therefore he should be the most important one to be involved with it. Fine. Now, Pisca, now the Mishnah continues, Milanu Godom Yosef from Nisasik Baila Moshe, who is greater than Yosef then, where Midah Keneged Midah, Moshe Rabbeinu was involved personally in finding his body and taking it out of Eretz Mitzrayim. So let's talk about that story. Tana Rabbanan, Boyer E Kama Chavivis Mitzvahs on Moshe Rabbeinu. Come see how precious Mitzvahs were to Moshe Rabbeinu. At that time when they were leaving Mitzrayim, Shekhar Yisrael Nisasik Baila Visa. Everybody else is busy plundering Mitzrayim. They were going around and asking the neighbors for gold and silver and whatnot. Vahunis asked the mitzvahs, and Moshe, meanwhile, was being involved with the mitzvah of finding Yosef's body in order to bring it out of Mitzrayim and to be able to keep their shavua that they had made to Yosef many years earlier. So in other words, Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Chacham Lev Yichach Mitzvahs, the Pasuk says the person with the wise heart will take mitzvahs, Ve'evil Sfasayim, and the one with foolish lips, Yilovit, will be punished or busy or confused, a few different meanings of what Yilovit means. Anyway, the point is that Moshe will call him Chacham Lev, he's smart, he realizes, Marsha says, you know, we have in Pirkei Avos, the expression, Hevim Hashem, Hefsid Mitzvah, Keneged Schara, and vice versa. So Moshe is like almost making a chesh. You know, yes, I have what to gain financially if I go and start borrowing gold and silver and whatnot from the Mitzvahim like everybody else did. But compared to that, that's the value of the mitzvah that I could do by fulfilling our Shavua to Yosef is inestimably greater than that, and therefore that's what I'm going to do. So the Torah, so therefore the Pasuk refers to him as a Chacham, that he realized that smart point that mitzvahs are worth more than any amount of Gashmiyistika wealth. What's this Evil Sfasayim? You love it. So there you have a couple of Mephoshim talk about. Eitz Yosef brings an explanation that one meaning of you love it means that they wear themselves out. So therefore, according to that, the Evil Sfasayim, you love it refers to the rest of the Jewish people. Now they were told by Moshe, who in turn was told by Hashem, that they should be asking the Mitzrayim for the gold and silver and whatnot. Nevertheless, they didn't have to be asking for so much. So therefore, we can call them in a certain sense, relative to Moshe, Evil Sfasayim, they're foolish with their lips. They're going and demanding more and more gold and silver and emptying out Mitzrayim, you love it, and they're wearing themselves out doing that, and they're missing the opportunity to do the mitzvah. Another point on it, though, Ion Yaakov says that actually the Evil Sfasayim, you love it, may actually refer to Moshe Rabbeinu. Meaning, he was saying that Moshe is eager to grab any mitzvah that he could. And he wanted to bring Yosef's bones into Eretz Yisrael. Well, he himself didn't make it into Eretz Yisrael. He didn't manage to finish the mitzvah. In the end, as we're going to learn in the Gemara later, the rest of the Jewish people had to fulfill the mitzvah and bring Yosef to his final burial in Shechem. So that meant, now what happened? We know Yosef misspoke by the whole thing with Mei Meriva. So therefore, in a certain sense, he can be called Evil Sfasayim. He misspoke with his lips. You love it, and the result of that is that he was punished and he suffered for that, and therefore he didn't manage to finish the job. So the point is, though, that we're saying that Moshe was a chacham. He was very wise for realizing that you have to grab the opportunity for a mitzvah whenever you have it, even if you could argue that other people could do it, or there's other things to do, or whatever. Yeah. So, minayin hayom yodeh Moshe Rabbeinu heichin Yosef kover. Well, how did Moshe know where Yosef is buried? Now, Maharsha points out that all the Shvatim, of course, all the progenitors of all the Shvatim passed away in Mitzrayim, and each Shevet took the bones of their ancestors with them when they left Mitzrayim. We learned earlier, for example, we have the whole thing with Yehuda's bones rattling around until Moshe davened for him. But then, everybody knew where they were buried. Shevet Reuven knew where Reuven was buried. Shevet Shimon knew where Shimon was buried, so it's not a problem to go and dig up the coffins and bring them. The problem is, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, that Yosef, the Mitzrayim, concealed where he's buried. So how is Moshe supposed to know? So Omru, so they said, Serach Bas Osher Nishtayra Me'os Adur. Serach Bas Osher survived from that generation. She had been among the people who came down to Mitzrayim. She's listed among the 70 in Parshas Vayigash. And she was still alive now, 210 years later. The famous thing that Yaakov gave her a bracha for long life, or even it mentions in Ovestid of Nussan that she went into Gan Eden alive because she had brought Yaakov the good news that Yosef is alive. She had revived Yaakov's spirit, and in return for that she lived long. It's mentioned, by the way, also in Sefer Shmuel. You have a story involving a rebel against David HaMelech, Sheva ben Bichri, who runs and hides out in a city called Ovel Beis Mechoila, and then a wise woman in the city manages to save the city from being destroyed by handing over Sheva ben Bichri, by having him executed and his head tossed over the wall. The Medrash says that this is also Serach Bas Asher. This is the city of Ovel Beis Mechoila, is in the territory of Asher, and she was living there at the time. So you're talking 600 odd years after they left Mitzrayim, and she's still alive. Yeah. So Serach Bas Osher is still alive. Holach Moshe Etzla. So Moshe went to ask her. Omala, he asks her, Chlumat Yadas Heichan Yosef Kover. Do you have any idea where Yosef is buried? Omala, she tells him, yeah. Oren Shom Matras Osu LeMitzvim. The Mitzvim made a coffin for him out of metal. Ukva'uhu Benilus. And they sank that coffin into the Nile. B'nilus Hanar, in the river Nilus, to Vishis Bochum Memuk, so that the waters of it should be blessed. Now Rashi points out, as we know from various other places, in Mitzrayim it almost never rains. How do they get their water supply? The Nile every year overflows and floods. You have the Nile comes from rivers in East Africa, so the snow melts over there on Mount Kilimanjaro and whatever, and it produces a lot of water in the river, and then so the river swells up, and then they have their Yehudim, they have their canals, that the water flows into them and irrigates the fields and all that. So they all depend on that, which is why they worship the Nilus, because to them it was their source of life, etc., etc. So now, and Rashi, in fact, brings in this connection. We have Novi Zakaria, which we read as Daftar on Chalamoed Sukkos, where it says that in the future, in Yemos Mashiach, all the nations of the world are going to have to come to Yerushalayim every year to celebrate Sukkos. And if they don't, then they won't have any rain. And as far as Mitzrayim, since by them it's not a matter of rain, by them what will happen is the Nile won't rise and they'll have drought. Anyway, the point is that so now they want that Yosef's coffin should be in the water in order that the water should be blessed and the Nile should keep on rising every year. So Ben Yehoyada points out, by the way, Yosef is the same. Actually, I think Balaturim already points it out that Yosef is the same gematria as Nilus. Yeah. Anyway. So Holach Moshe v'Omar das Fasa Nilus. So Moshe goes and stands by the banks of the Nilus. Omar, he says, Yosef, Higia Eish Nishbar Kodesh Baruch Hu Ligolos Yisrael. The time has come that Hashem swore he's going to redeem the Jewish people from Mitzrayim. The Higia Shvur Sheish Baita Es Yisrael. And so now the time has come for the Shvur that you beswore the Jewish people, that they should take your bones out. So imata maras atzmacha. So if you show yourself and I'm able to take your coffin mutav, then good. V'imlav. And if not, harayim enukim mishuascha. If not, then we're clear of your shvur because we can't do anything more than that. We talked about earlier in the perek that this is an example. The Taz brings this as an example where if you have a mutual deal that's sealed with a shvur, if one side backs out of their side, then out of their part of it, then the other one has the right to renege also. So therefore, Moshe is saying to Yosef, you got to do your part, and then we'll do ours. But if not, then not. Miyad Sofar Onesho Yosef. Right away, Yosef's coffin floated to the top. The Altismane, you're going to wonder, Heach Barzot Sof, how could iron float? Sharei Ksiv, you have an example from later on in Jewish history. You have an example with the Novi Elisha. The Pesach describes how his Talmidim went to the banks of the Yarden and they're chopping down trees to build themselves a new Beis Medrash. The Pesach says, Vayihi ha'echad matel ha'koira, one of them was chopping down a beam, v'echad barzel nofel ha'lamoyim, and then the wooden, then the iron axe head fell into the water. Vayitzak vayomer, and he cried out and he said, Aho ha'doni, please my master, woe my master, v'hu shol, I borrowed it and I can't afford to pay it back. And so Elisha asked him, where did for, and the pasuk says then Elisha took a piece of wood by Yashlach Shama and he threw it there into the river by Yotzef HaBarzel and the iron axe had floated to the top. So in other words, basically Hashem almost like interchanged the nature of wood and of metal. Usually metal sinks and wood floats, and here was the other way around. The wood sank and the iron floated. Now Vale Dvorim Kabachomer, Umay Elisha Talmid of Eliyahu. Elisha is only a Talmud of Eliyahu. The Eliyahu, Talmud of Moshe, and Eliyahu in turn is a Talmud of Moshe. Sofa bows him upon him, and yet the iron floated because of Elisha. Moshe, so the nickname Moshe, Rabbeinu, Allah has kama, how much more so it would do it for Moshe himself. So therefore, the iron coffin floated to the top there, and therefore it's not so strange. Marsha points out, it's one thing, for example, Kriyas Yamsuf, that was Hashem's direct command. There's no direct command of Hashem over here, but nevertheless, in the schools of Moshe, it could happen. There is actually a different place where it says that it's brought in Midrashim that Moshe wrote on a thing, Ali Shur, come up ox, because Yosef is compared to an ox, and then it floated to the top, and famously it says that Micha got a hold of that thing, and later on he put it into the fire where they were making the eagle, and that's why an eagle came out. Yeah. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola, Yudzayin here. When Hashem first created the world, the second pasuk of the Torah says, "V'ruach ha'lekim rachefes al pnei amoyim." The spirit of Hashem is hovering above the water, and the Medrash says, "V'ruach ha'lekim is ruchet shemalach ha'mashiach." And only then it says, "Vayomer ha'lekim yihi ur, vayihi ur." So even before light was created in the world, the spirit of Mashiach already existed. Finishing off halachas of Kiddush Levana, suppose that during Chodesh Adar you didn't see the moon earlier in the month. Comes Purim night, and then you see the moon. So you first do Kiddush Levana, and then read the Megillah. What happens if you see it in the middle of Megillah? So then it depends. Is there going to be time after the Megillah is finished to still be Mekadesh? Then you don't interrupt in the middle of the Megillah, just like we talked about before, about not interrupting in the middle of Kriyas Shema. If so, by the time you finish the Megillah, the Zman's going to be over. Then it depends. If the whole Kohol has not been Mekadosh yet, then they interrupt the Megillah reading and then go be Mekadosh and then and go be Mekadosh to Levana and then finish the Megillah. But if it was only a Yochid, then afterwards, the fact is, then if he doesn't finish the Megillah with the Tzibur, he's going to have to read it B'yechidus. And Pirsum and Yisra is more important. So the Noda B'yehudah says, in that case, let him finish the Megillah, even if it's going to mean that he misses the Zman of Kiddush Levana, because Pirsum and Yisra of the Megillah is more important. Not a man, I'm not sure if 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 I